Welcome to the Climate Change and National Security miniseries. My name is Duraid Jalili from King's College London, and I'm joined by Matt MacDonald from the University of Queensland. Over the course of this series, we'll be talking with key experts about how different government institutions are reacting and responding to the security implications of climate change, especially in the run-up to COP26. Welcome to the third episode of the Climate Change and National Security podcast mini-series. I'm Duraid Jalili from King's College London, and I'm joined by my intrepid colleague, Matt MacDonald from the University of Queensland. Today, we're talking with three leading environmental security experts on the climate security approaches of three major powers, China, India, and the USA. To give us some insights on the USA, I'm thrilled to welcome Erin Sikorsky, who is the director of the Center for Climate and Security and the International Military Council on Climate and Security, as well as being the former deputy director of the Strategic Futures Group on the US's National Intelligence Council. We're also joined by Dhanasri Jayaram, assistant professor at the Department of Geopolitics and International Relations at the Manipal Academy of Higher Education. Dhanasri is a world-leading expert on environmental security, as well as trends in climatizing the military in the Indian context. And last but not least, we're joined by Carl Holding, Senior Research Fellow at the Stockholm Environment Institute, who served as a research lead for the Institute's China Climate Security Initiative project, and who I'm sure will be bringing us new insights into the ambiguous green credentials of China's global investments. Erin, Dhanasri, Carl, it's great to have you all here. Thank you for joining us across so many different time zones. Obviously, as we head into COP26, all eyes are on the major powers. So I think this is a timely discussion for us to have. I'd like to kind of start off with getting a sense of how the different governments that you have been researching tend to view the relationship between climate change and security. What's the US perspective?
Sure. No, thanks for the question and thanks for having us. I think the US perspective has shifted over time from one where it was primarily focused on climate security as risks to infrastructure and military readiness, right? Bases along the Gulf Coast in the US being hit by hurricanes time and again, causing billions of dollars of damage, flooding in Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska, fires in California, all of that is still very important and critical. But I think the scope has broadened, if you will, in the United States to a better understanding of how climate change is shaping the national security environment writ large around the world, shaping conflict risk and instability risk in states, shaping competition among states, and really recognizing the need to mainstream climate change understanding across the national security community, that there is no job within the national security apparatus, whether at the Defense Department or State Department or intelligence community, that climate change won't affect. And so I think you've seen the Biden administration really take that on board from the beginning and work toward implementing a mainstream approach. I think there's a lot of challenges there that they're still facing, and happy to talk about those more, but I do think that's been the evolution here in the States of late.
And actually, you've done some really interesting stuff recently on the climatization of security discourse in the Indian military and government. How far do you think it compares with that US example?
First of all, thank you so much for having me. To talk about India's responses to climate security or the Indian perspective on climate security, it's still in the nascent stage. We don't have really much of a policy on climate security as of now. And the problem comes from the fact that we don't have a national security strategy either, where we can really pinpoint and say where climate change is really placed in the security strategy of the country. So in that sense, it's very difficult to say where climate security is placed. And to a large extent, India's position on climate security hinges on its positions within the climate change negotiations under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, and to a large extent also what discussions happen at the UN Security Council. So at the national level, there have been some attempts in the past to do some assessment of how climate change can impact security under the National Security Advisory Board and the National Security Council. But these are all individual efforts and very, very minor efforts, and which have not really translated into large-scale policy shift as far as climate security is concerned. The military, on the other hand, yes, does take climate security into consideration much more than the government as of now does. But even the military is kind of restrained or constrained to some extent because of the fact that the government still has to come up with a strategy that can something lead to a change in the military strategy as well. So maybe at the tactical level, they do take climate change into consideration. But if it's a strategic kind of change, again, I would say this is some way to go for the Indian military as well.
It's interesting to sort of hear that. I think, you know, in both of those examples, you have this, not a disconnect exactly between military and the political levels in the same way, but you have a level of contrast at the very least. Carl, I think we can tend to view China as a kind of a monolithic entity where the CCP has everything in a line, everyone in agreement. Do you think that there is a clear approach or view on the relationship between climate change and security across the Chinese government?
Well, thanks for inviting me to join here today. It's a great group of people that you managed to bring together here across time zones. So really happy for that to begin with. Well, China's view on climate and security, I think, needs to be seen in a much larger question about China's role in the world, where their way of acting on climate change is an important pillar for Chinese attempts to drive global governance. And so it's climate change essentially together with health, development, finance, and in global internet governance. So anything that China is doing or act, anyway, China is acting on climate change, where the UNFCCC is a very important forum, but where there are certainly other fora where China is promoting its idea of global destiny questions. Happy to talk more about that later, because I think there are increasing trade-offs between Chinese promotion of a world order and keeping of the world order, the liberal world order as we see it right now.
I think my question to the panelists kind of builds on what you were saying there, Carl. What actually drives the way that these different countries think about this relationship between climate change and security and how that's reflected in policy? We have this sense that policy is something that our leaders weighing the costs and benefit of particular approaches, but we probably know intuitively that there's something about how the international system works and how they view it, how ideology functions in these different contexts, how the military relates to the state, the effects of natural disasters or the impacts of climate change, all those things. So what I might do is go through in the same order, if that's okay, and ask each of the panelists, how would you characterise the key drivers of the country that you know the most about? How would you describe why it is they understand and approach that relationship between climate change and security in that way? If I can start with you, Aaron.
Sure, that's a great question. I think in the United States, my sense of the key drivers, I mean, one is cost and money and seeing the actual physical effects. And I think here, when you look at Congress, right, there's actually been bipartisan support for a lot of climate security action there in recent years, even during the Trump administration. And I do think the driver there was this focus on adaptation and wanting to not have to absorb these huge costs of natural disasters. And I think that it also offered an opportunity for those in both parties to take action in a way that was seen as less political as well. I think the national security context depoliticizes some of the climate change discussion a bit, especially when you're talking about adaptation and responding to things that are already happening. I also think, though, there's an increasing recognition on the, outside of our borders and other places that the systemic risk, right, whether it's from climate or from things like COVID, I mean, the drivers of that are shaping the landscape are changing. And so needing to absorb that in policy in a more sophisticated way, frankly, is driving some of the action, I think, from the Biden administration and others. But I think that is still a place where there's a lot of room for development within the national security community. You'll still talk to folks in the intelligence community where I came from that will say, yeah, climate change is real and important, but it's not our job, right? We shouldn't be looking at it. That's the scientist, that somebody else, is not us. And I think that's a real hurdle that still needs to be overcome to get to a place where we can truly understand and take action. Because for the reasons Carl's talking about, to understand where other countries are coming from, right? To understand India's foreign policy and India's role in the region, if you don't bring that climate change lens, you're going to miss things. So I think it's wrong for intelligence folks to say it's not their job, frankly.
Right. Thanks for that, Erin. Dana Stray, what's your, you kind of touched on this a little bit in your first response, but what do you see as the key drivers of the way in which India has conceptualized and addressed this connection between climate change and security?
So from my experience and from my research, what I see is that there are three levels at which climate change is linked with security. But again, like I mentioned, these are not something that translates into policy, but at least in terms of the discourse building, these are issues that have been addressed in various policy documents, maybe to some extent in the academic circles, maybe. So one of them is about the human security implications, which get addressed a lot because India's positions on climate change, as I mentioned earlier also, is linked with development discourse as well. So whether climate change impacts food security or water security, energy security. So these are some of the ways in which climate change and security linkages are addressed by some of the policymakers and also by some of the non-state actors, some of the think tanks, research institutes that are looking at security implications of climate change. There is also the discourse on regional security, because this is a region which has a number of border disputes and, you know, there's active conflict that is going on between India and China, India and Pakistan. So in that sense, how does climate change, for instance, may interact with the existing border disputes, or how does it affect, say, military strategy in the region? These are, again, things that are being discussed very often these days, in particular, I would say, recently. And third, as I mentioned, the military's efforts to mainstream climate change, that is becoming more and more clear, especially in the past few years. We saw that the joint doctrine of the Indian Armed Forces very categorically mentions climate change and environmental degradation as a point of concern for the military. I guess that also comes from the fact that the Indian military's deployment procedures in the Himalayas, for instance, are getting affected by climate change, or the naval bases, the military infrastructure along the coastal areas or islands like Andaman and Nicobar Islands, for instance, are getting affected by various effects of climate change. So these kind of issues, and plus, of course, the humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, because we are seeing an increase in the intensity and frequency of tropical cyclones as well. So in that sense, there is that increasing demand from the military to act on climate change, which is also driving these discourses to some extent.
Oh, that's fascinating, Dennis Ray, those different factors in operation. Carl, in some ways, yours is an even trickier question on those grounds, given that it's not always entirely clear or self-evident or to be taken at face value how China thinks about really anything to do with international politics or security. But what's your take on what you think the key drivers of Chinese engagement with this particular relationship are?
When it comes to the projection of China's military power, climate change is a big issue at all. Then if we look directly at Chinese climate policy, both domestically and more so how they are acting internationally, it's a complete disconnect between what they're saying they're doing and what they're claiming to do and what they're actually doing. So while Xi Jinping has declared that the Belt and Road Initiative is a cooperation that is green, healthy, intelligent, and peaceful, I would argue it's none of that. And it's definitely not green. And I think academic work and research work that has been presented over just the past year, not least from the Boston University database on Chinese global power investments, shows very, very clearly that while China talks about green investments, what they're actually involved in a major way, both in China and across the world, is investment in, for example, coal power, gas power, fossil fuel infrastructure, and very, very little of that, you know, sun and wind that we hear so much about from China is reaching the outward Chinese investment streams. So I think there is a huge disconnect here. We've studied it a bit deeper. We've actually looked into how China is portraying these investments through its own media, both Chinese language media and Chinese English language media, which is, of course, aimed for the rest of the world. And all of these projects are portrayed as green, sustainable, bringing cooperation and no negative side effects whatsoever, whereas international media would present Chinese outward investments in a much more problematic and rather brown than green way.
It's interesting that I suppose in a way, in that sense, you could say the key, you know, one of the key drivers behind its approach is the desire to be seen as a responsible global power in that sense, even if it's not substantiating that with the correct actions. But obviously that presents a really difficult challenge, in as much as if you are presenting yourself as this responsible global power, if you are that media at your disposal to be able to kind of project that image, how do you overcome that and push for specific action from that nation? Carl?
I think it's more than trying to portray itself as a responsible actor. I think that's the first step on the ladder. It's a bigger issue than that. And as I said initially, climate is one of those four pillars on which China is building its attempts to change global governance. And the core argument from Xi Jinping is his offer to build a community of shared destiny for mankind. That's his vision, the Chinese regime's vision of the world order that emphasizes sovereignty, you know, total respect for different political systems, and what China called win-win cooperation. So I think there is a very important argument at the bottom of how China is approaching the issue of climate cooperation. As we have also seen over the past year, the attempt to separate climate change issues, to not accept to, you know, at the same time talk about human rights, freedom of speech and things like that. So what China is promoting here is its view of a world order that is based on absolute sovereignty and respect for different political systems. My question is, could we cooperate on climate if, you know, those basic civil liberties are not part of the package? What's left? How could we cooperate on climate in a sensible way?
Well, I'll throw that question open to our other sort of panelists. Do you think there's, I mean, that idea of cooperation is obviously a major challenge for acting on the security implications of climate change. What opportunities do you think exist for that cooperation?
I think that's a good question. When I think about the climate security in China from the US perspective, right? Going back to this idea of understanding how climate change will shape other countries, I think too often we focus all on the cooperation and the mitigation piece and cutting emissions without having an understanding of how climate change will actually shape China itself, right? They have millions of people who live on the coast in regions that are threatened by sea level rise. They have right now, as you can see, their energy systems threatened by flooding. They've got food security issues due to desertification and fishing, changing fishing patterns and access. And so I think understanding all of that is important. And I think sometimes the either or competition or collaboration maybe doesn't fully understand the Chinese self-interest in cutting emissions to a certain extent, right? And how might the United States or other countries amplify that for the Chinese? Because I do think there is division within China itself on the direction, just as there is in the United States, right? There are interests that, right, that are want to maintain coal access and that sort of thing. And so I think it's important to bring that lens to the work. And I've heard folks talk about race to the top in terms of competition on mitigation and technologies. I don't think collaboration just for collaboration's sake is the right path necessarily. And they're separating some of these issues is important. But again, I'm not a China expert. I'm just looking at it from US and our thoughts around competition and that sort of thing.
Could I just respond there? I think it's odd that China, a country would arguably be very vulnerable to climate change, which was, you know, laid down very well by their own scientists already in 2006. How on earth are they not taking that on board in their own energy policy and other types of policies? Because it's not really reflected. I think China had a window of opportunity to go in a very different way in terms of electrifying and modernizing its country in the years from early 2000s until 2015. Instead, there is this new surge of coal power that is, you know, both inside China and how China builds relations in developing countries along the new Silk Roads. So this is, you know, it's odd to me. The only response that I have, you know, personally, it is about the Communist Party, the power to maintain the power of the Communist Party and the goal for China to 2049 to be at the pinnacle of the world. So these are overriding principles, sort of climate change as a corporation becomes just a token in that process.
Yeah, I not to let China off the hook by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it's hard for a lot of countries, frankly, and we see it in the United States and elsewhere. I mean, where there are huge vulnerabilities to climate change, but yet shifting the approach is really challenging. And so I think the question you hit on of why aren't they doing this is a good question for a lot of places. And so I think that's the key question of our time, frankly.
Just to jump in there to talk about China, because I think one of the biggest victims of Chinese projects which are happening in the Tibetan Plateau is India and also all the other countries in the South Asian region. And there is no transparency or accountability with respect to all these projects. And whatever data India gets from China with respect to Brahmaputra River, which is, again, a transboundary river, again, it's not a reliable data which we can really bank on. So in that sense, again, with respect to this transboundary cooperation on climate change itself, it's becoming very difficult today with the kind of military conflicts that are happening in the region. And if you really want to study what's going on in the Tibetan Plateau and what's happening to the glaciers there and what's happening to the geological features there, I think we need cooperation between the countries of the Hindu Kush Himalaya region, which is not just China, but 7 other countries. So which is not happening primarily because of these territorial contestations and China's own reluctance or, you know, refusal to really carry out any joint projects in the region. So these are things that are obviously going to come in the way of effective cooperation as we move on.
So it's interesting. China's starting to dominate the conversation. There's obviously a lot of concern that this could well be the case in Glasgow as well, that actually China becomes the actor that potentially prevents or characterises how successful we end up viewing Glasgow as a summit. But just on that, you know, we've touched on the role of different actors. Obviously, we've had climate change discussed in the UN Security Council increasingly. Lucille Martin's talked about this in our second podcast in this series, and we've had 2 of those discussions this year. But I'd be keen to hear again from each of you about what you see in this context as being the key trends or direction in climate security policy settings and influences in the country with which you're most familiar. So if we are to see likely challenges either to existing practice or things that could really trigger a change in the way that state views this connection, what do you see that being? Is it going to be international cooperation? Is it going to be a new administration? Is it going to be the effects of climate change? You know, and obviously there's a little bit of this that's through the looking glass, but someone like Erin, we think with her role at the Center for Climate and Security, is probably in a position where she gets to influence how the US administration actually thinks about this type of issue. So, Erin, what buttons are you going to be pushing?
Well, I hope I have that. We have that kind of influence with our group. I think there are 3 things, right? One is continuing to help them more granularly understand some of the risks. And I think the more we can paint a picture of how climate change will shape security risks in certain parts of the world that they really care about, but also then what their opportunities might exist as well. I think too often we focus just on the risks and not so much on the opportunities for bringing a climate lens to conflict prevention and peace building or to our relationships with allies and partners. When you look at surveys of ASEAN members, for example, of populations there, climate effects rise to the top of the concerns of the general population over regional conflict and things like that. And so I think, you know, taking advantage of that to share some of the tools that the US has built to evaluate climate security risks to infrastructure with those partners, I think there are opportunities there to strengthen relationships that are overlooked sometimes. So bringing that message, I think also then as everyone starts to agree on the risks, right? I mean, you've got the president here, lots of senior leaders talking about how important it is. Okay, it's like, what are you actually going to do? So where do you put, how do you put your money where your mouth is on both adaptation and on cutting emissions? I think that's the other key message here in the US is you got to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. And we have to adapt to the things that are baked in, right, over the next 10 to 20 years, even if you cut all emissions tomorrow. So that's critical. But you also have to cut emissions to make sure that you don't have catastrophic security effects in the second half of the century. And that is part of our message as well. And how can the military and defense department lead by example on innovation and emissions cutting? And obviously that's a complicated conversation with a lot of different variables, but I think we're moving toward that conversation, both here in the US and also at NATO with their new climate and security plan of action. Talks about mitigation. And I think that's the a next big conversation to have within militaries and security services.
It's fascinating. In some ways, our traditional conception of national security policy settings is that they generally focus on adaptive responses, that you basically try to manage external threats as they happen. But one of the things we'd associate with your center and the work that you've done is really trying to push this preventive agenda at the same time in the national security context of recognizing the importance of trying to, if not prevent climate change, because that's probably beyond us, that my understanding would be minimizing harm in that context.
Just briefly, I mean, I think, you know, as a former intelligence analyst, if I had had the predictive capabilities we have on climate change on any other issue I looked at, I would absolutely have used those in my work, right? And so I think that pushing the national security community to take advantage, frankly, of the fact that we have fairly strong predictive capabilities in climate and can build even better with a national security demand. So you're exactly right. The preventative piece is huge here. And unlike some other issues, we have more tools at our disposal, I think.
And Sri, how about the Indian context? What do you think is most likely to influence the way this relationship is viewed in the Indian context?
I mean, just to do a reality check, India is still a developing country with a whole lot of other priorities. And of course, like I mentioned, with all these territorial disputes it has in the region, of course, most of the attention goes to all these issues, and climate change still doesn't feature as a major issue in either electoral politics or in the government's priority list, if you ask me. So I think anyway, India was quite late to enter this, you know, this climate change action agenda at the global level for obvious reasons, because of the CBDRRC and other kinds of principles that have, you know, dominated the entire international climate policy so far. So in that sense, what can drive India's climate security policy in the future? I think, you know, one of the factors that is really going to play some role is definitely going to be the military. As I already mentioned, and from my own research, that is very clear that this is going to be one actor that is going to push the agenda somehow or the other through various agencies such as International Defense Staff, or, you know, now we have a joint chief of armed forces as well. So you have a lot of these new agencies that have been set up as well, which may look into the impacts of climate change on military readiness and strategy. So that's definitely going to happen. Another way in which I feel the climate security agenda may go forward is because, you know, for a long time, these vulnerabilities, just like in China's case, the vulnerabilities were not discussed much. So yes, we did a vulnerability assessment back in 2000s, which was published in somewhere around early 2010s. And after that, we had one major assessment report that came out, which was published by the Ministry of Earth Sciences last year. So it's only last year that we have really some, you know, we have put in place something that can lead to more policies or something that can deal with the risks associated with climate change. And also in terms of the adaptive capacities, I don't see much of preventive action or anything of that sort that may come into the picture as of now. But definitely adaptive capacities is something that is being looked into because of particularly the impacts on military, and secondly, because of the disasters. And, you know, these catastrophes which have increased in numbers, that is definitely having a huge impact on how even common people are viewing climate change, which was quite different earlier. Now they see this as a sort of a pattern which is affecting them on an annual basis, like floods happening on an annual basis, floods happening 5 times a year in certain places. Now, these are issues that are definitely catching the attention of the people. And therefore, I feel the human security implications, migration within countries, of course, migration across borders is still a touchy issue in this region. But migration within India, for instance, is also catching up as an important issue that needs to be dealt with, because provincial or state governments are also exploring ways of relocating people from coastal areas to interior areas. Now, how do you go about some of these, you know, initiatives? Again, I feel these are issues on which the human security aspects are definitely going to be looked into by the concerned ministries. However, there are differences between ministries and government agencies, which I'm happy to talk about if the question comes up.
We do get this narcissism of minor difference across the different departments of any country that recognises at some level this relationship, that yes, that it's not always clear that the different departments know what the other is doing and they have different agenda or priorities in terms of that response. Carl, China's traditionally been fairly reluctant to allow climate change to be discussed in the UN Security Council. There hasn't been that embrace of it at that level. Do you see any change in the future with that, or with climate policy more broadly in the Chinese context coming in?
I think that China is still keeping very important to be seen as a leader of the developing world. So there's a lot of joint, I think, positioning together with India, for example, on you know, issues such as fairness and justice in the negotiations. These are kind of keywords, as I see you're smiling there. I don't think China is very keen on the security angle of climate change. We want to keep it still as a basic, development issue, where China portrays itself as the forefront, fighting for the G77 countries and so on and so forth. However, as Danashri said before, there are issues, very concrete issues around Himalaya, for example, Chinese impacts in Southeast Asia and so on, Chinese impacts on other countries, low-lying countries and things like that, where there is a real security threat for these countries, which are partly driven by China's actions or lack of actions. So personally, I think there is a lot of ground also in the UN system to put more pressure on China, essentially. I do think that the speech by President Xi Jinping at the General Assembly a few weeks ago, where he promised China should stop building coal power around the world, is an interesting aspect of that. Not that it means a lot, because you could quite easily change coal power for gas and continue with the same infrastructure development, but it's important as an example of that China is sensible to international pressure that come from research, from media, from diplomacy, and so on and so forth. So I think in many ways, acting to make China partly change and become more actively involved in also mitigation efforts. Now, back again to how China views the connection between security and climate. I think it's key aspect of that is the Northeast Passage opening up and the navigational rights up there. That's a major thing for China. So I think China is really looking into this changing world with climate change and how to promote its own interest in that changing world, much more so than maybe acting upon mitigation and things like that.
So, of course, we're coming up to the 50th anniversary of the Stockholm Conference, the United Nations Conference on the Human Environment. And really, there's been since then this sense of this core North-South divide, developing, developed world. But arguably the climate context over time has really changed some of those divisions in important ways, that especially as we realise that, yes, there are developmental imperatives, but the countries that are most exposed to the manifestations of climate change are invariably developing countries. states who've risked being inundated are disproportionately affected by natural disasters, changing rainfall patterns, different agricultural outputs and all those types of things. So that's one of the really fascinating things about how alliance structures have worked within the UNFCCC system. But I'll hand over to Jurade to bring us home.
Thanks for that, Matt. We'll need to sort of close off, unfortunately, because it's been a really fascinating discussion. I'd like to finish off just by democratizing the podcast a bit and asking you, are there any key points that you think people should be aware of or people need to look out for regarding these debates?
About India's position on climate security, I just want to add that it's also important to look at where India stands internationally on climate security. So there is a schism when it comes to the national and the international discourses. So nationally, there may be more awareness of climate security or how does climate change impact security in different ways. But when it comes to the international position of India in the UN Security Council, for instance, it's very clear that India is very reluctant to associate climate change with security. It still maintains that there is not much evidence to link climate change with conflicts. It's against any sort of militarization of climate debates. It wants UNFCCC to be the only agency that will look at climate change and act on climate change. And also to a large extent, because of India's own position in the UNSC, because yes, India is there in the UNSC for 2 years. It is so-called, you know, major power that wants a permanent seat with veto power in the UNSC. It's important to look at India's position from that perspective as well, because India wants to be on the global high table. It's not part of the P5 as of now. And it sees UNSC as this unrepresentative organization where issues like climate change cannot be discussed, where you can reach decisions based on consensus, as it would be the case in UN General Assembly or the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. So in that sense, internationally, I think it would be very difficult to for the international community to really push India into cooperating on climate security related concerns as of now. But there is scope for cooperation at the regional level with especially neighboring countries like Bangladesh, Maldives, and other countries. At least there is some sort of convergence on climate action as of now. And also nationally, as I mentioned, even at the national level, this is a discourse that is just building and something that is just, you know, moving into that policy mode where everybody is taking it more seriously. So I think there is much more scope at the national and regional level as compared to the international level.
Carl, over to you.
We'll just follow up on what Anasui said about India's position about climate and security. China, as we discussed before, has very much the same opinion. They don't want to talk about security issues. They see climate change as a development issue, predominantly to continue its position as a leader of a developing world. So I think we have to accept that. On the one hand, China has been quite successful in portraying themselves as a country that is in the forefront of green development. And of course they are. They're the biggest producers of components for solar and wind and so on and so forth. But I think we've been forgetting about the fact that China is the largest emitter and that China got off with a not a very ambitious target in the Paris Agreement, where they're allowed to increase their emissions up to 2030 and then plateau them until 2035. Only thereafter should China's emissions start to decrease. So I think what is important is to scratch the surface of the image of China, the image that China has tried to make of itself as someone who's ahead and comes to green solutions, and point to the fact that they have the capacity to develop green solutions, but also point to the fact that domestically and in their international financing, they're not using that. They're not promoting that type of green development. I think more limelight to that fact. To also point out the opportunity for China to be a much more progressive on green development is something that could be very useful in the run-up to Glasgow.
Turning to the United States at the end here, I think one thing to watch for is that there will be a slew of reports and assessments coming out from the U.S. government that were tasked as part of President Biden's executive order on climate coming out here in the next few weeks, perhaps by the time the podcast is released. And so I think those documents, there are going to be risk assessments, there's going to be something look at climate and migration issues, will help the international community understand where the US is coming from on the issue and how they plan to work on these issues going forward. And then also how they'll be adopted into the national defense strategy and the final national security strategy, both of which should come out at the end of the year, beginning of next year. And I think that's going to send an important message to the international community. And then the US will be using those documents in their engagements with partners. I think we can expect the Defense Department to leverage climate as a potential area of collaboration with other militaries and bring it into conversation more frequently. And I think they're right to do so, frankly, because I think you cannot separate the impacts of climate change on the security landscape. Whether folks want to talk about it or not, it's going to be a factor there. And understanding it and bringing a climate lens to those conversations is critical for making sound policies going forward.
I think a lot of our listeners and my students will be thrilled to hear that. The prospect for these new kind of reports and new insights to come out. But I think at the same time, they might also be devastated to know that I will be setting them as required reading over the next term.
You're a cruel man, Gerard.
Well, I'll just close off by saying thank you so much to everyone. It's been a really interesting discussion. And I think to have this kind of comparison between these three major powers and to get that sense of the similarities and the differences, there seems to be a significant amount of room for change, but also some areas of hope there. So thank you again. And we'll hopefully all see each other soon. Thanks for listening to the podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. In addition to this series, the University of Queensland and King's College London are working together to create open access educational tools on climate security challenges and opportunities. We'd like to thank the King's COP26 engagement grant for funding these activities and the University of Queensland for providing us with new insights from its Climate Change and National Security International Responses project. If you're interested in learning more, please visit the Environmental Security Research Group webpage at King's College London.